Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I am honored to share the microphone with the most interesting people. These are people who may be entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, authors, speakers, small business owners, virtual assistants, attorneys, anybody. These are people who have wonderful stories to share and who are excited to freely share their business wisdom as well as tips and actionable advice. In short, they are willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And today I get to welcome Dave Freeze to the show. Steve Forbes, the editor-in-chief of Forbes Media, has called him a grandmaster of communication skills, and Elite Books has called him one of the 50 most influential business thinkers today. Dave is an attorney, an author, an entrepreneur, and a speaker who has lived a fascinating life that took him across the globe and exposed him to master communicators, persuaders, and negotiators in hundreds of nations and across many, many cultures. He is a master of teaching enhanced communication and how to go from being persuasive to truly influential. He has been called to teach leadership, sales, and marketing, interrogation, and negotiation to audiences ranging from computer hackers, I love this, computer hackers turned good guys, to entrepreneurs, military, and civilian audiences, including CEOs, students, administrators, and or faculty of colleges and universities, including Harvard, Yale, the University of Pennsylvania, Cornell, ASU, and many more. He has also spoken to Travelers, Aramark, GE, AstraZeneca, Comcast, and hundreds of corporations and professional associations. This is a busy man. He has appeared on NPR, PBS, Fox News, Mind TV, and on over 120 radio and television programs, and has authored several books related to persuasion, influence, and business. And he co-authored Einstein's Business with M. Scott Peck, Stephen Covey, and many other voices of the success. I'm getting stuttering here. I'm excited to interview of the success and personal development movement. And now my question is, what in the heck are you doing on the radio with me? Welcome, Dave. I am so excited to have you here.
Excited to be here. And, I do like sharing the things that I learned. Sometimes I learned them and shortened my growth curve by, seeing mentors do them or having them explicitly teach them to me. And then sometimes I learned them the hard way, but have found out that the hard-earned lessons were worth learning. So happy to share.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. You're talking a lot about enhanced communication. And when I knew you were coming on the program, I started kind of following you around. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure what that means. But before we get started, that is my first question. Before we get started, is there anything you would like to tell our audience before we take off?
No, I'm happy to just start answering your question. And so I like, in a way, you would think if I'm so good at communication and you were following me, you should know what enhanced communication means, but it's deliberately vague for this reason. It sounds good, and it sounds interesting, and it sounds like something that would be useful. So most people do want to know more and want to know, what do I mean by that? That's called the Zarganik effect, where by asking a question or making a statement or with our branding, we create curiosity or an interest, a desire to know more. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that today and what enhanced communication is and why it matters so much to anybody that's listening that's in business or starting business or managing people within a business, because really good communication, really good persuasion skills and becoming influential, and we'll talk about what the difference is, those are all massive leverage. By that I mean we could spend a little bit of time working on them and making ourselves better at them and reap massive, massive results and benefits, not just for ourselves but for our clients and customers and for our team and our partners and whatever business we're involved in. So I'm going to pull back the curtain and show you not just the strategies that great communicators have and employ that make them so good at it, but also some little cool tactical things you can practice doing right away. And one of the things I'm going to ask
Excellent.
At the end is, what did we learn? And then what are we going to do? Because I'm a believer that learning doesn't really occur until something changes. So
action.
I'm going
to
be
you have to take action.
Exactly. And I'm going to be encouraging
right.
your listeners to note down the things that sound fun, but then figure out how we're going to use them.
Excellent. Say that one more time. I knew, like, I'm not a silly person or a stupid person, I don't think, but I couldn't figure out what you meant. And I was, okay, I have to find out. So I'm so glad you explained that. But tell me one more time what that effect is so I can look it up.
Ah, the Zargynek effect. Yeah. So the Zargynek effect, I'll give a couple more examples as we go. It's a way that we, as really effective communicators, can kind of change the biochemistry of other people so that they're interested in what we're going to say and paying attention to it. I could give you another example. And I'm going to teach a technique today, I think, if you want me to, called the six-word question. And if you're Googling the Zargynek effect, you can also Google Dave Freeze and the six-word question, and you'll be able to see video of me doing this technique. That's a really easy way to learn it and kind of master it. One of the things that I like to talk about is how we overcome refusal or barriers in other people's minds. So, do you have children, by the way, Denise?
No, I don't.
You've
I have cats.
Them,
do they count?
Yeah, they do, actually. And you've seen kids. You've seen parents interacting with kids before. So you'll
well,
probably recognize
I have seen kids bullying their
about.
Parents more often than not. But, yes.
Yes. So, you've probably seen this dynamic before. Parent wants child to do something, probably something that the parent's pretty sure is good or important for the child. And so they'll say to them, I want you to do this. Maybe it's take a music lesson or participate in a sport or ride a bike. And kids, when they refuse something like that, when they're asked or told to do something and they say no, it is often because they're afraid. They're afraid they haven't mastered it or they're afraid they'll look silly or be embarrassed. And so when a parent says to a child to do something and the child says no, a supportive parent usually says, well, yes, you can. You can do it. You know, if a child says, no, I can't, a supportive parent says, yes, you can. Problem with that is that that violates all the rules of great and enhanced communication and negotiation. What we're doing is we're starting somewhere where we're in profound disagreement. You wanted the child to do something. They said they can't do it. You said they can. So they go into their brain and they go, I just told mom or dad I can't do it. They aren't listening to me. They think I can. Here's all the reasons I'm right and they're wrong. So we've started off by erecting a barrier rather than removing a barrier. So as I was learning these skills, as I was learning negotiation tactics and interrogation, I realized that that is a bad way to start with the kids. So what I would do is I would say, oh, I know you feel like you can't yet. I'm leading to the Zargynek effect again, but teaching one more thing as we go, which is if a kid says they can't and you say, yes, you can, you're in disagreement. But if they say, I can't, and you say, oh, I know you feel like you can't yet, we've moved them because now they're going to agree with us. They go, yeah, they heard me. I do feel like I can't. But they just went from the absolute of I can't to I feel like I can't, which is less permanent. And then we added this presupposition. We said, I know you feel like you can't yet. But that means they have to. Just to understand our sentence, they have to imagine themselves being able to do it. So we moved them twice from the absolute of I can't to just like, I feel like I can't, to imagining themselves doing it. Now here's where the Zargynek effect comes in. What I would do if it were my kids is I'd say, I know you feel like you can't yet. And then I'd change my tone of voice and look around and say, where's your mom? Because if a dad says, where's your mom, what comes next is almost always awesome. So the kids will lean in and they'll listen. That's the Zargynek effect in a different way there. What I do is I said something to them that sparked a little bit of curiosity, maybe a little bit of anxiety, and then I changed my tone of voice and I leaned in. They're likely to lean in too, by the way, and be wondering. They're neurotransmitters are going to change, and they're going to be the neurotransmitters of intense curiosity and a little anxiety, and they're going to want to know, what is Dad going to say? So the Zargarnik effect is when we do something, we make a gesture or say something or ask a question that causes curiosity or a heightened more intense interest in other people and paying attention to what we're about to do. So it's a very cool little tactic, something to learn to use. We all do it intuitively, but learning to use it more often, not carelessly, because if you do it to people all the time, they catch on to your game. But people find it very hard to resist the Zargarnik effect when something is creating real intense curiosity. Does that make sense?
It actually does. And while you're talking about this, I'm thinking back to times when I've done it and kind of knew I was doing it, and times when I recognized it was being done to me and resisted it with all my might just because I'm that way. So,
well,
I think that works.
It is true,
yeah,
that you try to resist it with all your might, but it's also true that we, at some level, we can't, because we're hardwired to the Zargarnik effect, and the reticular activating system are parts of our, you know, our process in our brain that protect us. So the reticular activating system is the part of the brain that picks out stuff that goes from unconscious into conscious awareness. So, you know, our sensory organs, our skin and the nerves in our skin that give us feeling, our olfactory sense of smell, our eyesight, our hearing, all of these senses are bombarding our brain with way more electrical data impulses than our brain can call into conscious awareness. We can't be consciously aware of all of them at any given moment. So the reticular activating system is kind of the gatekeeper for that. It says, here, this is important, look at this. Here, this is important, look at this, or feel this, or notice this. So if I said to your listeners now, notice the feeling of your bottom in the chair, in the seat that you're in, which maybe you are, maybe you aren't, but you wouldn't have been aware of that until you heard me say it. And then your brain is going to go check. It can't resist. It comes into conscious awareness, whether you want to fight it with all
I
your might or
did.
Not. Of course.
I just checked my... And you know what? I'm really not all that comfortable. I'm going to stand up now.
There you go. So you're right. You could notice this being done to you and try to resist it. That's why I say use it sparingly, and you want to use it in an environment where you've already probably established trust, or there are times when you've established enough rapport where you can use it pretty early on. But you're correct that you don't want people to realize that this is – you don't want to be a one-trick communications pony. You don't want to just – do the Zargarnik effect over and over again. There's lots of ways of getting people's attention and holding it. But that is a fun way. And if you make it fun, people can be addicted. Actually, if you do it fairly often and they're rewarded by what you say being something that's interesting or fun or fascinating or which engages them, then they'll get into the habit of wanting to listen to what you're saying. And that's something that we'll talk about as we go today, which is kind of transitioning from being persuasive, which is good to do. It's learning to be persuasive means you can learn to get people to think about things and look at things in new ways and to change their minds about things, but that's hard work. Whereas influence is where you're continually persuasive in a trusting environment where you've really figured out what people need and you persuade them to get what you have and it's what really delivers for them. And then they begin to know and like and respect you, and they trust you. And then they realize, well, you're a valuable source of information to me. You make my life better. So they turn to you for information and advice and counsel. So they're already coming to you expecting to hear what you have to say and to want to do it and to like it. And so that transition from being merely persuasive to highly influential makes you very, very powerful. So you've got to use it ethically. And by that I mean, you know, we can persuade people of things if we work hard enough at it. But getting them to trust us means that we have to really, really, really listen to what they are saying, what they need, what they're interested in, how they describe things, and then make sure that we're only delivering to them the solutions that really work for them or advice that's really good for them. And then trust is taken to a new level where you are influential and people are coming to you saying, what do you have for me now? Here's my problem.
Well, and you see this with the big marketers. Of course, I instantly go to the internet because that's where I live. That's where I breathe. You see it, you know, with people like Jeff Walker. You see it with people like Tony Robbins. I mean, this is how they operate, yes?
And how they build massive audiences. Because,
right,
of course,
right.
Jeff Walker and Tony Robbins don't resonate with everybody. But they're very careful to find the people who will respond to them and know and like and be able to use what they have to offer. And so when you look at the reviews of their programs and what they do, they're rave reviews. And occasionally, of course, like with anybody, there's somebody that says, I don't know what everybody else is talking about. Tony Robbins doesn't speak to me at all. Well, that's okay. If he did, he would be mediocre at what he does. He's great at what he does because he is controversial and thought-provoking and is not for everybody, but he really knows his audience.
That's a good point. I mean, some of the people that I am willing to know, like, and trust in the internet marketing, you know, kind of arena, what you said a minute ago, I mean, it really resonated with me because I go back to them time and time again. When they come up with a new product or new program that I'm pretty sure I need to further my business, they're the ones I go to. Now, there are other people doing, you know, likely the same thing, largely the same thing, but I'm already committed to really trusting these people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they keep that business coming in time and time again. It's very smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing they know what you know. I hadn't thought of it like that before, but clearly they know something.
Well, one of the things that I think that the best ones are good at is identifying the market again. So if I can use I'm a trust and estates lawyer by training, and so I could try to sell trust and estates planning to 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds all day long. And certainly 30- and 40-year-olds who are married and have children should do wills and powers of attorney and things like that. It's just what they should do. But getting them to do it is very hard. They're new in their career. They're a new parent. They don't make a lot of money. They're trying to buy a new house. There are all these demands on their time, and they have limited resources, and this is not a priority for them. It doesn't do planning their estate and facing their own mortality is not something that they do. So once we realized that by 53 or 54, most people who need the kind of services that I provide, most of them have had a parent die or become incapacitated or face a health challenge. They've had a friend die. They've seen people go through these things where they were unprepared and how bad it could be. They're further along in their careers or the businesses they've owned have become successful, and they have the ability to take the time off to do the work, and they know they need to do it, and they have their resources to pay. So once we stop trying to market to somebody that needs what we want but doesn't want it, and we marketed to people that need what we want and who already want it. They know they want it. They don't know enough about it, so we have to educate them, but they know they want it and that they need it and they have the ability to pay. Once we chose that market more carefully and really started to market to married people with children between the ages of 53 and 67, the marketing became much easier. Because notice, we went from marketing to men and women in their 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s to marketing to a very specific group of men and women at a very particular age in a very particular geographic region with a very particular set of sort of economic circumstances. And so we got big by going small, by figuring out exactly what these people really wanted, how they talked about it, what they needed, what solved their problems. Now, of course, those solutions are not the same for everybody. But we really paid attention to who wanted and could pay for what we had. Then, after a year or two of having really great success and a lower cost of acquiring clients because we knew exactly who they were and how we could go to them and how to reach them, then we started getting referrals from those folks, and they were people like them. And then we started paying attention to, okay, of this group of 53 to 67-year-olds, who are our best ones? What do they look like and sound like, and what are their problems, and how do they differ from the clients, you know, that aren't the top 20% but are the bottom 20% and who cause all the trouble and who take away from our ability to properly service other clients who want what we have and are pleased by how we deliver it. And so we then started to modify our marketing and to communicate in a way that really appealed to the top 20, 30, 40% of the clients that were giving us all the profit and most loved what we were doing. And we would find things that would gently repulse the other clients. So one of the things we found is our really best clients already knew they were going to have to spend some money and time and resources to do this. They wanted it done right. So we would explain in marketing materials and educational materials and articles why people would wait a long time to get to see us and why they'd pay more. Now, that's going to be intriguing to somebody that realizes the value of estate planning. Really, this guy, people will wait 6 weeks or 2 months to see him? Why is that? Is he good at what he does? I mean, there's the Zarganic effect going. Again, people are asking themselves questions. But people who are super fee sensitive, which we found generally translated into, they wanted it to go fast. They didn't want to dedicate the time to it. They thought that would cause it cheaper. There were all these things that made them not a good match with us. And so that same stuff that appealed to the people we wanted now gently repulsed the people we didn't want to spend time sort of sorting through, knowing that in the end we would probably not be a good match for them. So that's, something that everybody should be thinking about is, who are my best clients, customers, patients for what I'm doing now? Who do they look like for the products and services I want to offer in the future? And who are the worst ones who are not a good match? By the way, when you're thinking about that, who your best client should be, so that you could get big by going a little bit narrower, just also think about who are the ones that are the most profitable and the most fun, and of that group, the easiest to provide the higher-end products and services to, and of that group, who naturally refers the right kind of people to you. And those are the ones you really want, but that'll be a small percentage of your overall clients or customers or patients.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I call them tire kickers, but I have found through experience, I've been doing this for a long time, and I have found out that the ones who are very fee conscious, they will nickel and dime you to death and take up an incredible amount of your time, and they're not fun. They're not fun at all. Mm-hmm. So I tend to turn those people away almost from the start. Again, not knowing why I was doing it, I just kind of put it down to spidey sense, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to know that there's actually a system inside me that's protecting me, so to speak. I'm fascinated with this. So you mentioned this 6-word question. Do you have time to go into that?
Sure.
Does that fit into what we're talking about?
So the setup for that was when we talked about the Zarganic effect, and it is where somebody, look, I was using the example of my kids. I asked them to do something. They said, no, I can't. Instead of saying, yes, you can, I said, I know you feel like you can't yet. That is getting them to think about being able to do it. Then what I would do is I would look around and say, where's your mom? Now, of course, if you're at the office and you're talking to somebody named Judy and you need her to get you a report by Tuesday and she's saying she can't, you would not look around and say, Judy, where's your mom? Because that would be creepy. But you could lean in a little bit and say, Judy, come here a second. Just change your tone of voice. That's going to trigger that Zarganic effect. And when she leans in, you might say, so here's the 6-word question. I'll give you the simplest version of it, and then I'll go back to what I would tell Judy. The simplest version is you say, I'm just wondering or I'm just curious, because this sets the stage. The question that's about to come is not intrusive. You're not judging. You're just curious, which is a state of mind that people understand and they are not threatened by. So you say, I'm just curious or I'm just wondering, and here's the 6-word question. What would happen if you did, or what would happen if you could? So if a child is afraid to ride the bike and you say, I know you feel like you can't yet, but I'm just curious, what would happen if you did, or what would happen if you could? They cannot understand that question without making a mental image of themselves or internally representing to themselves them being able to do it. It's like if I say to you, don't think of the color blue, you must think of the color blue in order to understand my sentence. It's not possible not to. You must. Just how the brain works. So when I say, I'm just curious, what would happen if you could, they will imagine themselves being able to do it. In the office, we'll go back to where we were talking to Judy or June, whatever name I gave her. If you said, Judy, I need that report by Tuesday, and she said, oh, I can't. But it's really important for her and for you to get that report by Tuesday. And you would say, come here a second. I'm just curious. I know you feel like you can't yet. But what would have to change in order for you to feel completely sure and confident that you could get me that report by Tuesday? And she'll probably say, oh, I would need somebody to answer the phones, or, oh, I would need somebody to take this other file, or, oh, I would need somebody to do this. So she just went from an absolute, I can't do it, to a very reasonable request for something where it can be done. So that's the magic of that six-word question, and it is magical. It is the thing that, as I've taught this stuff to hundreds of thousands of people, I get the most emails and letters and responses and calls about. It is just it just has a magical effect.
Well, it does. I was being Judy while you were talking, you know, and I was saying, no, I can't do it because, listen, it, you know, sometimes you really feel like you just can't, or honestly, you just won't. And immediately when you asked that question, in my role as Judy, I went, well, you know, yeah, I could, you know, maybe have somebody answer the phone. But I put it in first person. I could ask somebody to answer the phones. I could ask somebody to take the file off my hands instead of putting it back to you. So I instantly took ownership of that.
Yeah, that's what, if you did try to put it back on me, I'd bounce it back to you. But
you're right.
Most people do it. Most people just accept and shoulder the burden. They go, they come up with a solution. So great, they just came up with it. They own it. And then they go carry it out. So it's pretty good technique.
It really is. And, you know, I was thinking, well, good for Judy. She figured it out in a heartbeat there. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense, and it's very quick, isn't it?
It is. And like I said, if people – we went through that pretty fast. But if people want to see it and hear it, I think if you Google Dave Freeze and the six-word question, you'll see probably multiple videos of me explaining that. And you can, you know, listen to it, watch it, and see the gestures and things too.
That is excellent. I'll make sure that goes in the show notes. Okay, you had mentioned influence rather than persuasion is the real goal of people, of business owners, of leaders, of marketers. Can you explain the difference between influence? You did a bit, you touched on it, but I would love for you to go deeper.
Sure. So these things that we're talking about, they're what I call tactical. They're the things that we do to be persuasive. But they're preceded by strategy, and here's what I mean by that. Great communicators don't get frustrated when a particular tactic or trick or technique doesn't work, because no technique works with everyone every time. It just doesn't work. People are under different kinds of stresses. They have a different kind of makeup. Some things are more persuasive to them than others. Some things catch their attention or move them, while the next day it might not. So the strategy of great communicators is to sort of accept responsibility for the communication. I think in NLP they say the quality of my communication is the quality of the response I get. That puts the person who's asking for things at cause, and great communicators do that. They don't get frustrated. They practice flexibility, and they take responsibility so that when they ask for something and an inferior thing results, so that they understand that that was probably their fault for not being clear. This makes them really good at taking the time to check back in with people and not getting angry or frustrated, which shuts down your creativity rather than enhancing it. So the anybody can learn to be persuasive with the tactics, but they won't be as good as somebody that learns the strategies first. You have to be a strategic thinker about communication to ever hope to become influential. Because if you just learn a little tactic and you use it all the time, you'll wear it out and you'll find that it's unsuccessful with a certain number of people, and then your brain will start to doubt whether that's a good tactic and you'll stop using it and you just won't be persuasive anymore. But somebody who's really strategic about communication, they know they have to remain flexible. They have to take responsibility. They know the words that they use don't mean the same thing pretty much to anybody, not only to everybody. The words don't mean the same thing to any individual person. So, for example, if I say to you the words turkey sandwich, you get a picture of a turkey sandwich in your brain, right?
I do.
And can you describe it to me? What kind of bread was it on, for example?
Ciabatta with a lot of mayonnaise and pretty much nothing else.
And it's the thin sliced turkey or the thick sliced turkey?
Thin. Very thin.
Thin sliced. Now, ciabatta, that could be a ciabatta roll or a piece of bread sliced from a loaf of ciabatta. Was it a roll or was it a piece of ciabatta bread?
Piece of ciabatta bread.
And was the mayo, was it a particular kind of mayo, like Hellman's, mm-hmm. for example?
Hellman's.
It was? Okay, oh, Hellman's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing. If I say to you when you're going out, hey, could you pick me up a turkey sandwich? You might say, I'll do you one better. I'm going to make you this ciabatta turkey sandwich or wherever you get it. But that may or may not be exactly what I wanted. I might have wanted a thick sliced turkey on rye. So if you bring me that delicious ciabatta sandwich, which you described, by the way, whose fault is that I didn't get exactly what I wanted? It's my fault because you made the picture of a perfect
turkey sandwich.
You didn't
specify.
Right.
Exactly. You didn't ask for exactly what you wanted.
And if I love Hellman's and I don't ask for Hellman's and I get some Miracle Whip on there, that's not going to taste good to me. But that's because I didn't think about it and ask about it. So this is the turkey sandwich is a metaphor, obviously, for being more careful about how we ask for things and checking, because the words we use trigger an electrochemical reaction in the brain of the other person. And they generally speaking make pictures, most people do at some level, whether they recognize them or not, of what it is that they're that they've been asked about. And that picture may look very, very different from the picture that's in our mind. So if there were that many variables in the simple request for a turkey sandwich, imagine if you've got a project at work that's got a lot more moving parts. And great communicators, strategic communicators who eventually become persuasive, they know that it can't just be all about them. They've got to get the ego out of the way. If every project has to be solved with their perfect solution executed in exactly the way that they want, well, one, they're going to be disappointed, and two, they're training their team not to be creative and come up with even better ideas. So, yes, as the leaders of our organizations or the owners of our businesses, we do have a responsibility to provide leadership. But the best way that we could do that is to develop clear thinkers and leaders at each and every level. Because without that, you're going to ultimately, the growth of your business is going to be ultimately limited by how fast you can run on the squirrel cage. But when you get other people who you encourage to be creative and who you develop trust in and you teach them the essential goals of what it is that you're trying to achieve and let them, with the greater knowledge they probably have of the customer if they're in closer contact with them, come up with solutions and empower them to do that. At first, they may need to tell you before they implement them, but eventually they should be telling you, here's what I did, so that it doesn't spiral out of control or that you're not making assumptions. But they're telling you about the good ideas that they implemented. So this is all triggered by your question, what's the difference between persuasion and influence? And persuasion is both strategic and tactical, but you never get to influence unless you focus on the strategies of great persuaders. And those strategies are, have a clear outcome for what you're about to say and do and how you're going to communicate it. Know what you want in advance. Having said that, be open to solutions other than what your ego is telling you is best because you came up with it. Cultivate flexibility so that when something goes wrong, you just go, okay, that didn't work with this person right now. What's next in the toolbox? Develop a really big toolbox of these tactical tools and develop your acuity so that you can see the effect you're having on people. I'm sure, Denise, that you've been speaking with someone and had the sense or seen in their eyes that they weren't following what you were saying. They really didn't understand, but they were nodding yes because they didn't want to disagree with you. Well, when you have acuity, mm-hmm. when you really get good at that, you recognize it. You know, I got to go back a few steps here and find out where we want to stray so I can get them totally on board so they're not just saying they understand it. They really do understand it. So these kind of big strategic common factors that we see in great communicators, ranging from salespeople to spiritual leaders, you want to cultivate those so that you go merely from just getting people to think about things and coming around to your way of thinking to buying your product to having them look to you as a known and trusted source of information where they share their innermost fears and concerns and wants and desires and their needs for solutions, because that's going to make you really best able in your business to to adapt your new products and services to what your best customers want. So that's kind of the leap from merely being persuasive and changing somebody's mind or getting them to recognize, yeah, I probably really do need this thing. This probably really is a good solution, to where they're saying, hey, you gave me the last six good solutions I've ever had. I trust you every dollar I spent, like you talked about some internet folks that you buy from consistently. When they come out with something, you're going to go buy it because they have not led you astray. And, by the way, if you really trust them, even if they do make a mistake and they come out with a single bad product, you're more likely to go, ah, that was just a mistake. They weren't trying to steal from me. They just didn't do as good a job as usual. And you're not going to punish them in the same way you would punish someone in whom you did not have that level of trust and who wasn't so influential to you.
Exactly. I'll tell you where I learned that. I have a client that's been with me for years, you know, probably 10 years or better. And he's actually a very, very well-known person in the fitness industry. And he had a very small list starting out, very small. But you talk about a warm list. Anything he put out, people were standing in line breathlessly to get. And that continues on now with a much, much bigger list and a much bigger sphere of influence. But everything he put out came from the heart. He mm-hmm. knew what he was delivering, and he stood behind it 100%. And I learned so much just by watching how he operated. But on another topic, it's interesting that you should be talking about these things, you know, talking about managing your team and bringing them in, because I put up a graphic on Facebook yesterday. I must have known you were going to be talking about this. But basically I said, manage by objectives. Tell people exactly what you want them to do and then get out of their way. And I've learned that the hard way too, because, boy, I'll tell you what, starting out, my ego was big. I don't ask my team to do anything that I can't actually do myself. And there was a time when I was doing it all myself because, you know, why have somebody else do it? Wore me out.
Well, I'm like you. I like to know and understand it. Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
I do like to understand it, but then you get to a point, even depending on the size of your business or the nature of what it does, you get to the point where you can't even do that. You can't learn all the skill sets that the people have who are working for you, because there'll be people that are way better at it. You don't, you know.
I'm getting there, and it's a little bit embarrassing, but it's also like, ooh, you know, I can trust these people and I can just say, okay, I've seen your work. I know what you do. Here's the bigger picture, because I have to bring them into the bigger picture. I don't like to hand off just a little bit and cripple them enough that they can't come back with suggestions or consult with me. So, you know, I give them pretty much the bigger picture and say, show me what you got.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing is that sounds terrifying to some people who are in small businesses.
It is.
You know,
it was.
Because we've all had situations where we've handed off a project and it's gone bad. But that's because we probably handed off that project out of desperation too soon, because we didn't really build leadership in our team in a timely way. So we should take responsibility for that too. But, I just think that the sooner you get on this project of hiring people and building people who can exercise good judgment when they have real clarity of what the mission is. And that's important, and that's our job, is to give them real clarity. And then a system to get back to us to tell us when, you know, when they've done things. You know, for example, I've had people that made changes that were not good because they didn't understand everything. Well, probably my fault for not informing them of all the pieces of this, but we would do A, B, C, and D, and they just stopped doing C because it didn't seem efficient to them. But nobody told me. So I'm telling clients or customers or somebody that C is being done too, and it's not. So that's bad, because they made a change and I didn't know about it. So one of the things when you're doing this, it'll give you more confidence too, is just say to people, when they get to the point where they can do it, okay, you can make changes. You know, that's within your power. Because now they've 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 times come to you and suggested a change and it's been good. So you now know and understand they have the capability to do this. But now you can say, well, you can make those changes. You just got to tell us when you do it so the rest of us know.
You would think that would be intuitive, but it's not. And people just kind of work in their own little desk or their own little, you know, line of sight, and they forget that they're part of a bigger team, and, you know, you kind of need to know what's going on.
Well, there's an interesting story. You know that I run a program, I think we talked about this off air, where I bring in spies and interrogators and guys that have run counterinsurgency ops and ex-military and special forces operators, to teach people, men and women of all ages in all different kinds of businesses, what they learned either in clandestine service or running one of these operations or in the military that was a real force multiplier that, you know, kept them alive or helped them in the military, and that they've come out and applied in civilian life in business. So this is not, sometimes people say to me, oh, I really love your programs, but, you know, I don't have any military background. Well, good. This is all the more important for you. This is looking at the world through a totally different lens. But here's a good way to think about this issue we've been talking about. Jocko Willink, who is speaking at my event this year, Navy SEAL, Lieutenant Commander, retired, commanded a task unit in Ramadi where there was very ferocious fighting for a long time. And Jocko would say, look, if I send out men and they understand commander's intent is to take a particular building, but really what they want is the high ground in that neighborhood. And they get there, and that building has been blown up, but there's another building that gives them a good or even better vantage point. Well, great, they can go into that building, but they got to tell us, because we might send bombs in to that building if we don't know they're there. So I like this example because Jocko would say to me, you know, in the military, when I give somebody an order, I better make sure they not only understand it, but that they agree with it. And they're free to disagree, because what if they know something that I don't? Because when I give them an order, unlike when you or somebody, or now when he's in civilian life, if he tells somebody to do something, they're not going to die because they did it. Whereas in the military, they might die if they don't do it right. Same thing here. You got to call back and say, we got to the location. The building we were supposed to take is gone. We're going to take this other building. Make sure you know we're in here so you don't bomb that one. And you should be thinking the same way. And I have found that people who have had no military background and gone to these programs come away from it saying, I learned things I never thought I would learn, and that have made a dramatic change and difference in my business and how I look at the world.
Well, it sounds like you're not just talking about communication, but you're talking about awareness at many different levels. The awareness that you need to communicate, the awareness that this could go sideways 6 ways to Sunday if you don't let somebody know what's going on.
I also just found something for you. You remarked about your client who had this very small list of, you know, truly devoted followers and fans. And there's a great article on that. It's called 1,000 True Fans. I believe it's by Kevin Kelly. And if anybody wants to Google that, or you want to put that in the show notes, it's a really succinct and smart discussion of why what you were describing is so important. Don't try to go big and get 10,000 fans that are lackluster in their interest and buying patterns. Go deep and narrow and get, you know, 100 or 500 or 1,000. And he kind of lays out the logic behind it, as well as the mathematics and business in that article.
Okay, I've got the title. What was his name again?
I believe it's Kevin Kelly.
Kevin Kelly. I'll look it up and put it in the show notes. Thank you.
Sure.
Because I'm telling you, I watched this go on for a long time. And when I say small list, he may have had starting out about 30 people. Now, of course, it's much, much larger. But he has gone from strength to strength to strength by knowing who his target market is. He doesn't deviate from that, as far as I can tell. And, I mean, he knows these people well, and they know him, and they would go to the ends of the earth for him. And, I mean, he does it straight from the heart. There is nothing, I'm sure there's strategy and tactics behind it, no question, but it comes from the heart, and he just applies the strategies and the tactics to get his word out.
Having clarity about your own strengths and weaknesses, your own skills, and having clarity about who you like to work with and who your best clients are, coupled with the ability to develop sort of the sensory and situational awareness you were talking about, where you start asking your best clients and customers, what did you like about what we do? What didn't you? What did you find most surprising? What were the barriers? What made you afraid to buy it? Why did you ultimately decide to? And finding out how they talk about and the language they use is a recipe for just massive success, not only in business but in your personal life then. Because when you start to ask your kids or your spouse or your partner, you know, oh, what do you mean by that? I want to make sure I know and I understand. Like, when you're telling me to get you this, is this what you want? And they say, oh, no, you know, I didn't want A, I wanted A with B. And once you get in the habit of doing that and delivering to them more precisely what they want, whether they're, you know, in your personal life or your customers, that's impressive to people. It's memorable to people because so few people do it. And then they all start to mirror that back to you. You set up this virtuous cycle of self-improvement and improvement in relationships, because when you show someone you care enough to ask them and to be clear and to make sure that you're delivering what they really want, then they start to do that too. They go, that was nice when he or she asked me about that. I'm going to do that. So that everybody starts taking a little bit more responsibility for the outcome of their communication. And when everybody's doing that, that creates a really strong response. So when everybody in an organization is doing it, or in a relationship or in a family, you'll find that everybody's having a better time.
I find that with my web development clients, it's all too easy to just say, okay, send the deposit, I'll get started. But I learned a long time ago, I have to have really an open communication with them. I'll send them some graphics or something. Okay, what do you like about this? Do we need any color changes? Let's get on the phone. Let's go over this and make sure that I'm delivering what is in your head, and often what I think they're thinking, not even close. So I have to be very clear with them that I'm actually picking up their vision and creating it. And I
the
think
other
a
thing
lot of people
probably
don't do that.
No, they don't. And the other thing you're probably doing, consciously aware of it or not, is that there are times when the client comes back and says, oh, I would really like this. And you know it's a mistake. They don't really completely understand the reasons. So you can't just say, no, that's a mistake, because now you're sort of challenging their judgment. But you can approach that by saying, here's what we found in the past about that. I just want to give you a heads up, because I've done this, you know, I've used this color 20 times before. And in test after test after test, it underperformed this. The client has no way of knowing that. So if you just tell them, no, that's dumb, don't do it, you're not going to develop influence with them. You're not going to be persuasive. But if you could share with them, if you could say, you're the boss, and ultimately we're going to do what you want, but I understand your big goal is to get more clients. And because I do so much of this, I have access to information you might not know. So when you're thinking about that color, let me tell you this, that we tried it 20 times before, and it underperformed this other color. And I understand that you prefer it for yourself, but it may not be what your clients want. So if we want to try it, let's try it and test it in a split test between this and the other one and see what your clients really want, because I don't want you to lose business if I'm wrong, and I don't want you to lose business if you're wrong about that. So that's a whole
exactly
different way of presenting it to them, that you have more knowledge than they do without seeming to distrust them.
It is, and you will have, and I'm sure you've had this happen too, you know, shiny object syndrome, where once they start seeing it, you know, once I get them into the back end and they can see what's going on, all of a sudden creativity kicks on their end, which I'm always delighted to see. But with that comes shiny object syndrome more often than not. They saw a marketer do this lead page or this optimized press or this lead capture, and I'll say, okay, but, you know, listen, let's go back to what we first talked about. What you need, what you're talking about right now is absolutely something you're going to need, but that's phase three. That's not part of this particular, you know, part of the project. So do you want me to work it in now, or should, you know, let's talk about it. And they almost always go, oh, yeah, you're right. Let's put that down the road because it's just not the proper time. But you have to
have this getting something up and working. Yep. Getting something up and working is better than trying to do it all right the first time.
Right. And I find that we're doing phases one, two, three, and four, depending on if we're taking on the marketing. It doesn't matter what we're going to be doing. But to try to get it all done at once is really a silly idea. So I've learned to, you know, negotiate with the client and say, okay, let's do this part now, this part, and, you know, you're right, what about those colors? We'll see, you know, let's talk about that as well. And the more I chat with them, the more I bring them into the process, the happier they are with the end result, and the more they're going to keep coming back to my company because they trust me to have their best interest. Like my idea of a web development project is I never, ever take your deposit and then the final payment and say, hey, thanks for the payment. Good luck. God bless. I am not handing you a pretty boat anchor. I want to make sure that you understand how to drive traffic to it. You know, if you need lead pages, we'll talk about that in another phase. If you need email marketing or social media branding, we can talk about all that, because what I want to hand you is a turnkey solution, period.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and as you say, that's a brilliant strategy.
That's very important.
To keep them spending.
Well, and it keeps me, you know, kind of in the loop, so they don't go in and break something and then all of a sudden they're, Denise, guess what I did? Oh, geez. And, you know, sometimes I've had to go back and recreate whole websites because they got slap happy in there. So I try to prevent that with training after the fact. Again, lessons learned, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any examples of how, you know, you've worked with, I love this, leveraging the military intelligence multipliers. I love that. Do you have any examples you can share, like maybe from the stage
Sure.
or in some of your coaching programs?
Sure. So I guess in that program, we refer to them as force multipliers, which is an expression in the military used to describe something like a technology or a skill or an attitude or an ability that makes a given force more powerful than it otherwise would have been, or makes a resource more useful or go further. So Colin Powell once described the attitude of optimism as a massive force multiplier, meaning that optimistic forces tend to perform better in the field than those who are pessimistic or who feel defeated. Night vision is a technology that is a force multiplier. So if you give a soldier night vision, they will be able, it's about a 5 times force multiplier, so a small force of men armed with night vision should be able to defeat a very much larger force of men who do not have night vision if they can choose to engage the battle at night. So those are examples of what a force multiplier means. What we do is we work through meta-strategic force multipliers, strategic force multipliers, and tactical force multipliers. So tactical force multipliers are the little things that you do. So in your business, creating an opt-in page or a way for a customer to identify themselves as a buyer, maybe making a small purchase, you know, coming up with a strategy to do that, that is a force multiplier. Like if you can find out from your audience something they really need to know more about, and that the better educated buyer is more likely to buy from you, and you then create a book or a report or a video or a webinar on that, and then you drive traffic to it and you capture their names. That's a force multiplication type of strategy, because you're identifying people who want what you have and probably need it, and if they paid a little bit for that, are by their nature buyers of information, not just, as you called them, you know, like a tire kicker who's looking for everything for free and may never really become a good customer. So what we're constantly doing in these programs is, we did one last year, not the Business Black Ops, but a 3 Days to Success program, where we took and went through all these laws of physics and of biology and evolution, and we said, how could any of these laws apply in business? So, for example, in biological evolutionary terms, every species, whether it's a plant or an animal on Earth, overproduces its offspring. So shad, for example, if all the shad eggs that were laid and fertilized turned into shad, the oceans would be filled with shad in a few short generations. So not only do animals produce too many offspring, so that the offspring not only have to compete with other species for resources, they have to compete with their own siblings. Why is that? Well, one of the theories of evolution is that is because as conditions change, there'll always be some of the babies that are best suited in that environment to survive, even when others cannot. And they will continue to reproduce and kind of rule that world until the environmental conditions change again. And so if you apply this to business, what we see happens is most businesses never really think about their market and what they want. The ones that do think about their market and develop products and then go try to sell them, they'll do okay and they'll sell some. But the ones that really focus on the market and what the market wants and builds products around what the market wants, they will have an easier time of it. But the businesses that really thrive are those that are constantly coming up with new marketing ideas and are adaptive to changes that are taking place with their products and services. But very, very few businesses do that. Here's the problem, though. The very few businesses that create lots of different marketing and products and services quickly find that they've got all these products and services out there when only one or two or three at any given time are making up 80, 90% of their profit. And they are expending time and money and energy developing and sending these other products and marketing techniques out into the world that don't do anything. And so this is a rough way to put it, but in that situation, we have to learn to, from nature, we have to learn that some of those babies have to go. And when we run these programs, these marketing programs, and we test them and they don't work, or where we try a new product or service and it doesn't work, I'm not advocating quitting early, but I'm also not advocating, nor does nature suggest, that we should be banging our heads against the wall forever. Go back to the drawing board. Make sure that there's a couple of good profitable products producing lots of money for you, but if you want to create a new one, go create a new one based on what the current environmental conditions are and what your customers really want. Get rid of the old stuff that's just not working, because it is a drain and it is a weight and it is that attractive boat anchor.
I'm curious, does anybody know, do you know why these companies tilt at windmills? I mean, why they haven't kind of done a resource audit or a product audit and determined what is working and what is not, maybe what can be put aside and maybe reworked at a different time? It doesn't seem logical.
Well, they come up with all kinds of excuses for it. We were talking once with a company that I was working with about their SKUs. You know, they have a product identifier for each product, and they had something
right,
like 100,000. And of course, the top like 50 to 100 made almost all of the money. So you'd think it would be easy to get rid of, at least have the courage to get rid of the bottom 20, 30, 40%. But they would say things like this: oh, no, they're lead generators, or people come here because of the, you know, amazing diversity of possible choices. But there were products that nobody had bought in ages, or that so few had bought that there was no way that even collectively they could be responsible for much of a company's business. So we make excuses. We fall in love with the stuff that we create. We're afraid that once we've created something to get rid of it. But again, I've experienced the most growth in many of my businesses through the years when we've really meticulously gone through and jettisoned the stuff that just was not working but was costing us time and money and energy.
See, that makes sense to me. I mean, it's just logical to realize that you have to kind of narrow it down and manage what is manageable, because the other stuff is taking up time, energy, money, resources.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't understand that thought process.
And it violates a military strategy, which is that you keep your forces concentrated. You know, the more you spread them out, the more they're all in danger.
Again, perfectly logical. Do you know, this has been the fastest hour. We only have a couple of minutes left. Is there anything? Would you please come back another time? We haven't even tapped, I think, what you can offer the audience. I would love to have you come back in maybe the autumn.
Sure, be happy to. And
well,
I just had a great time. Thank you so much.
Well, is there anything you would like to impart to the audience before we run out of time?
Well, if anybody is interested in any of those live training programs where you get to meet Jocko Willink or some of our nation's heroes, you could always go to days2success.com. But I have a website, which I'm sure you'll put in the show notes, successtechnologies.com. I'd go to /blog. We have hundreds of free resources and articles and book recommendations and things like that there for folks on these kinds of issues of strategy and tactics and marketing and enhanced communication skills. So,
yeah, that is already in the show notes, but I will be adding some others, and I can't wait to read this article by Kevin Kelly.
I think you're going to like
where
that.
Can people? Yeah, I will. Trust me, I will. Because when I tell you I learned so much about my own business by watching my client, I can't even begin to tell you how important that has been to me. And thank goodness he popped into my life. I mean, I really learned an amazing, and continue to learn an amazing amount of things from him. So one more time, where can people find you?
I am on Twitter at /Dave, D-A-V-E, Freeze, F-R-E-E-S. And I'm on Facebook at /David. Freeze, F-R-E-E-S.
Great. Well, Dave, thank you so much for being with me here today. It has been wonderful chatting with you, and I know our audience enjoyed the takeaways as much as I did. And the show will be available for download in about an hour, and you can also find us in iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Dave Freeze, and I will see you next week. Dave, I will be in touch to get you scheduled again, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.